This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Everything Here is Beautiful by Mira T. Lee. Read for you by Cassandra Campbell, Emily Wu Zeller, Ozzy Rodriguez, Kim Mai Guest, and Paul Bamer. For the families. Empathy, because the commonality among human beings is emotion. And the only way we can bridge our vast discrepancies in experience is through what we feel. Let us be humbled in the knowledge that one may never fully understand the interior lives of others. But let us continue to care. Prologue. A summer day in New Jersey. A house with a yard. The younger one, 4, likes to fold her body over the seat of her swing, observe the world from upside down. She circles her feet, twists the pair of steel ropes until they're all the way wound. She kicks up her legs. The swing spins. She likes the sensation of dizziness. The older one, 11, in the kitchen, chops ginger and scallions, puts on the rice, sets out a small plate of pickled radishes. It is early morning. Their mother is still asleep. On Mondays and Thursdays, she attends night classes at the local college. On Fridays, she works at the accounting office until late. "One more year," she has said, though she has promised this before. She has come a long way since her husband died, and she was forced to come alone to America. The mother will soon sit for another actuarial exam. "An excellent profession," she tells the girls with pride. They know only that it involves a lot of math. The older one sits at the kitchen table, opens her tin pan of watercolors, paints with quick, smooth strokes. She will try a still life today. That bowl of peaches, or a vase of Shasta daisies fresh picked from the garden. She likes the feeling of focus. When the rest of the world falls away.
"Jia, come look," her sister calls from outside.
The older one doesn't look up.
"Come here. I found something."
She sets down her brush, heads out to the yard. The screen door slams shut behind her.
"Can you see it, Jia? There."
In the corner by the fence. Wet grass tickles her feet. The younger one points to something in the low branches of the dogwood tree.
"It's a spider web, Mei-Mei. See how its threads stretch from this branch to that one?"
It is their first summer in New Jersey, their first house with a yard. Before, they lived in Third Uncle's basement, in Tennessee. The younger one's eyes, wide.
"Don't worry, Mei. You don't have to be scared. Spiders won't hurt you. They catch flies and mosquitoes and all kinds of other insects. See the web? The spider spins it with the silk from its body. It's sticky. The bug gets caught in those strands and the spider eats it. It sucks out the blood."
The younger one nods, ponders this information. The older one turns to go back inside.
"But..."
The older one, impatient, though she isn't sure why.
"What, Mei?"
Her sister is pointing to the web again. It shimmers in the sun, catches the morning light.
"Look, Jia. See? It's beautiful."
Part 1. Chapter 1. Miranda. Lucia said she was going to marry a one-armed Russian Jew. It came as a shock, this news, as I had met him only once before. Briefly, when I was in town for a meeting with a pair of squat but handsome attorneys. His name was Yona. He owned a health food store in the East Village, down the street from a tattoo parlor, across from City Video, next door to a Polish diner. Beneath 3 floors of apartments that Lucia said he rented out to the yuppies who would soon take over the neighborhood.
He had offered me tea, and I took peppermint green. And he scurried around, mashing Swiss chard and kale in a loud industrial blender, barking orders to his nephews. Or maybe they were second or third cousins. I never knew there were so many, because they were sluggish in their work of unloading organic produce off the delivery trucks. He yelled often. I thought, this Yona is quite a rough man. He dusted the wine, mopped the floor, restocked packages of dried figs and goji berries and ginseng snacks on the shelves. He was industrious, I could see, intent on making his fortune as immigrants do. Lucia said he played chess. I'd never known my sister to play chess, though she was always excellent at puzzles as a child. Yona didn't seem to me the kind to play chess either, nor to drink sulfite-free organic wine or eat goji berries. But, as they say, love is strange. And I wouldn't begrudge my sister love, nor any stranger, not even one who smoked, and was the kind of man who looked disheveled even fresh after a shower, and would leave his camo briefs lying around on the bathroom floor. I admit I was disturbed, creeped out by his prosthetic arm, which he wore sometimes, though more often I'd find it sitting by itself in a chair. Lucia brought him to visit our mother, who was dying. Our mother was tilted back in a green suede recliner, wrapped in cotton blankets, watching the Three Tenors video we'd given her the previous year. She took a long look at this man, his working man's shoulders, his dark stubbled jaw, his wide flat nose. Her Yoni had the essence of a duck, Lucia said, endearingly. Or maybe a platypus, though she'd never seen one up close. My sister liked to discern people's animal and vegetable essences. In fact, she was usually right. Our mother winced as her gaze settled upon his left arm, a pale, peachy shade that did not match the rest of him. "What happened to your arm?" she said.
"An accident, when I was 21.
He said it quietly, but without any shame.
"In Soviet Union?"
"In Israel. I moved there when I was a teenager."
"You are divorced," she said,
and I tried to read his thoughts in the fluttering of his blue-gray eyes. I wondered if Lucia had warned him that our mother was like that. I wondered what had been shared, what omitted, when the two of them exchanged stories over chess, over wine. I wished to say to this man, "Do you really think you know our Lucia?"
13 years,
he said.
"I have been divorced for 13 years.
Our mother winced again, though it could have been from the pain shooting through her bowels, or her bones, or her chest.
"You are Jewish," she said. "Jewish are so aggressive. You have children?"
"Two,"
he said.
"They are with their mother, in Israel."
At the mention of the other woman, our mother spat. Once, I suppose, she would have wanted to know more. Like, what did he do? Or how old were the children? Or what were their names? Or did they play musical instruments? And we might have told him that Lucia could recite 20 Chinese poems by the time she was 3. Or that she was a real talent on the violin. Or that she'd suffered a terrible bout of meningitis at age 6 and nearly died.
"Why are you divorced?" she asked.
"We were married too young," he said.
The skin of his face seemed to hang off his cheekbones. "A basset hound," I later said to Lucia.
"This is life,"
he said to our mother. She did not seem quite satisfied with this answer, though she nodded, expelled a heavy sigh.
"Take care of my daughter," she said.
But she was not looking at him. She was looking at me. She fell asleep. 2 weeks later, she was gone.
"Three piles," said Lucia. "Everything in 3 piles.
Keep, Salvation Army, trash." This was our strategy, tasked as we were with selling the house in New Jersey, as specified by our mother's will. Our childhood home, marred by death, now considered inauspicious.
So we sorted Corningware and gas bills and soy sauce and ice trays and Cabbage Patch dolls and garden hoses and yarn and frying pans and Maurice Sendak books and twin bedsheet sets with faded Raggedy Ann and Andy pillowcases. Keep. Trash. Keep. Keep. Salvation Army. Trash. And when we reached Ma's bedroom, a hallowed hush, as if to acknowledge the finality in this sacred act of disturbance on which we now embarked. The desk where she'd worked, pencil in hand. The throw pillows Lucia sewed 1 year in home economics class. The portable radio. The clock. Her Reader's Digests. The bed where she'd lain tethered to her morphine drip. Eyes closed. Silent. Body slack at last.
Fashion show? Whispered Lucia.
Well, why not? We peered in the closet, the one we'd raided often as impish children. We picked out 2 vintage cotton sundresses, one with chevron stripes, the other zigzags.
Twirl! Said Lucia.
You, I said. And in unison, our skirts puffed out like upside-down tulips. We burst into tears. 12 cycles of chemotherapy. 3 surgeries. 3 courses of radiation. 2 clinical trials. 3 remissions. 4 recurrences. Over 9 grueling years. Yet the permanence of Ma's absence still came as a shock. We worked until late. At 2 in the morning, we decided to bake. We blasted ABBA and Blondie and the Rolling Stones. Broke out in song as flour and sugar flew everywhere.
Almonds! Said Lucia. We need almonds!
Chinese almond cookies were Ma's favorite. So we set down our spatulas, drove to the 24-hour pharmacy to shop for nuts.
We'll be roommates someday in an old folks' home. We'll be cranky and play bridge and complain to the nurses about our hemorrhoids.
When you're 80, I'll only be 73.
No doubt the grief made us giddy. The late hour. The fatigue. But it was like that, to be with Lucia. We fell asleep in the family room. The house buttery warm. The waffle weave of sofa cushions imprinted on our cheeks. And then morning came. And with it came Yona, roaring up the driveway in a giant rental truck. They married quickly, in City Hall. Lucia wore a sparkly tank top with pink bicycle pants, silver hoop earrings. She beamed, like a bride. Yona wore his best khakis, a wrinkled white shirt, a bright red tie.
I thought, this is who my sister is marrying. A man the shade of gravy, with a missing limb and a spaghetti sauce-colored tie.
I'd never expected my sister to marry a more conventional man, or a Chinese man, or a highly educated man with a spotless resume. Lucia had dated a Greek boy in high school, chosen NYU over Cornell, rejected math and sciences for English, all to our mother's dismay. And while her college dorm mates had busied themselves with one incestuous hookup after the next, Lucia met a soft-spoken drummer who lived with 4 other musicians in Tribeca, ditched her violin for electric bass. She found her wanderlust, too, foregoing the air-conditioned offices and suits our mother and I were both familiar with to teach English in Ecuador, tutor in Brazil, volunteer at an orphanage in Bolivia. In her early 20s, she worked as a travel writer in Latin America for a small startup firm, before returning to study journalism. She wrote feature articles now for a newspaper in Queens. The next best thing, I suppose, as there she was friendly with halal butchers, Egyptian barbers, Salvadoran cooks, and the old Chinese grocers who sold dog penises and exotic mushrooms for $600 a pound.
Still, I had not imagined this.
Yona beamed. Like a groom. He beamed with the whole of his wide duck face and his wiry brows and his small sticking-out ears.
"Take picture now!"
he barked, and I followed him through the rectangular window of my camera, trying to see what Lucia could see. And yes, he was rugged, fit, masculine. Attractive, one could say. I'd never thought of Lucia marrying before me. After all, she was younger by 7 years. My Maymay. They had signed prenuptial agreements. At my insistence. I did not think Yona was marrying for our mother's money. Not a fortune, but far from meager. Nor for Lucia's American citizenship. But I felt my concern was reasonable.
Take more picture,
he said. I did not like how often he spoke in imperatives, though I understood that English was not his native tongue. We had that in common. I did try to like him. I did. After the 2-minute ceremony, he hugged me fiercely, strong as a bear.
Sister,
he said.
Ahoti, hermana, sestra, belle sœur.
Jie, said Lucia.
Jie,
he said in a remarkably accurate third tone. He laughed from his belly. I liked that about him. Then he scooped up Lucia with his good arm and carried her down 7 flights of stairs, out to the plaza where spring blossoms danced and songbirds chirped, and a rainbow might have appropriately appeared. He spun her around and around, and Lucia shrieked with delight, her arms outstretched, head thrown back, bobbed hair and sharp chin shining in rays of new sun.
My wife! She is beautiful!
He sang, and Lucia's eyes shone with such clarity that even my most shrouded worries burned off like a morning fog. They were in love. Our mother, I was sure, could know this safely. From wherever that place is where the dead view the living. He welcomed me to their home. It was cramped, a 2-room apartment adjacent to the kitchen of the health food store. It smelled like cigarettes. In the windowless bedroom, 4 black-and-white security monitors sat stacked on a large steel desk, cluttered with paper cups and ashtrays and framing nails and remote controls and piles of Lucia's small girly clothes. Lucia decorated their marital bed with oddly shaped pillows. Clover, heart, frog, banana. She loved to lie there snacking on pita chips or yogurt-covered pretzels, watching the store. That's where he first saw me eating macadamias, she said dreamily, pointing to the bulk nut bins on security screen 1. In the living room, a twin mattress was laid out on the floor. It served as a bed for Yona's visiting nieces and nephews or cousins or uncles, whoever was passing through. Lucia loved the bustle, the chaotic, hostel-like feel of the place. The organic kibbutz, she called it. And now it was her home, too. Do you believe in happily ever after? She asked me that day, as we sipped peppermint tea from our paper cups. I recalled the stone-faced art professor I'd recently dated for 6 weeks. Felt a slight, involuntary jerk of my brow. Slight, but noticed, because Lucia noticed these kinds of things. Oh, yeah. She sighed. You could at least try to believe. She reached over to hug me, patted my head, like she used to as a child. That night I lay on the twin mattress and listened to the sounds of the two of them panting and moaning, gooey and fucking like rabbits. My sister was officially a newlywed. A wife. It came to me suddenly, as a blunt ache inside. I'd never felt more alone. Yona was frugal. Our mother would have approved. Every other Sunday he dragged in furniture from that Middle Eastern flea market on 12th and B.
Listen,
he said. That's what he always said.
Listen, you wanna know something? The yuppies, they love this stuff. You know how much this cost?
I examined the 3x4-foot tea-stained mohair rug.
$20,
he said.
Second-hand store. You pay 200. This one you clean. It's like perfect.
Perfect, said Lucia. She painted the bench outside the store a bright berry red. Bought a 12 tropical-looking plants to decorate the cafe area, which had been recently expanded to include a fancy soup and salad bar. And now all the neighborhood characters came to mingle in the exposed brick aura of their urban oasis, lounging to trip-hop or Moby or Ella Fitzgerald.
Lucia promptly declared them her favorites. While young people huddled over soy milk beverages, many of them lesbian hipsters or drama students or aspiring environmental activists. I cannot say I particularly liked the way my sister behaved around her new husband, or how he'd speak to her often as though she were a child.
Lucy Goosey,
he said.
She'd hated that nickname all her life.
I made you your favorite food in all the world. Shakshuka!
Shakshuka? Lucia loved our mother's spare ribs. Yes, those tender pork spare ribs marinated overnight in honey and garlic and five-spice powder.
I love you, Lucy Goosey,
he said, scooping runny egg and tomato into her mouth. He kept kosher. Our mother would have been disappointed. She would not have trusted a grown man who was coarse like a rhino but who ate like a bird. I did like how he always made efforts to welcome his customers.
Hola!
To Juan Carlos, the Colombian guitarist.
Guten Morgen!
To red-headed Mikhail.
Konnichiwa!
To Mrs. Sato.
And Chow Chow!
To Mrs. Sato's long-haired Pomeranian. They liked him. They liked to stop and chat at his store. Later, Lucia told me, Yoni, he can't read or write English.
What?
I said.
What do you mean?
Lucia shrugged. This saddened me, because my sister had always loved words, their sounds, their rhythms, the moods they conveyed. As a child, she'd sit for hours on the toilet with a dictionary in her lap, circling her favorite words with a stubby red pencil. But how does he run the store? I said. He has business partners. Cousins, she said. Uncle Leo does the bookkeeping. Cousin Abby does the ordering. Yoni manages the workers. He's a people person. She would teach him if he wanted to learn. Later, she said maybe he didn't want to learn. But he reads and writes Hebrew, I said. Sometimes. She shrugged again. Do you know how many words I write down in a day? She took out her tall, spiraled reporter's notebook and flipped through page after page of meticulous notes and lists. I write down everything.
So? I said.
Yesterday Yoni wrote down 6 Hebrew words.
6 words?
I said. I did not understand. I worried about her then. I tried hard to read her tiny handwriting. And her face. 6 words, she said. Some days 1. Some days none.
So what? I said.
Can you imagine? She said. He organizes everything in his brain. Yes, this was pure Lucia. She found an immigration lawyer, filled out duplicate copies of form after form, gathered glowing letters from the lesbian owners of the tattoo parlor down the street, the manager of City Video, the Polish chef next door. And within 6 months, Yona became a proud green card carrier. Lucia could be resourceful like that. Efficient. Like her mother. And then she was determined to help him quit smoking. She brought home pamphlets and read them aloud, signed him up for support groups, bought nicotine gum, hid his ashtrays, then his Marlboro Reds, until he roared, and made him watch videos of blackened, cancer-infested lungs. She monitored his cough, and when it didn't go away for 4 weeks, she made him his first doctor's appointment in 10 years. Occupying the twin mattress that winter was Yona's aunt's best friend's son, Haka, fresh from Haifa. So when I came to the city for a business meeting, I offered to stay with a friend. But Yona huffed,
"Ridiculous!"
He moved to a long, cushioned bench in the cafe so I could sleep with my sister, and I said thank you and tried to ignore the cigarette burns on the sheets. Lucia and I lay awake, propped by pillows, snacking on egg tarts and pineapple buns from our favorite Chinese bakery on Mott Street, watching episode after episode of Sex and the City. Lucia had faithfully recorded them for me on videotape. In the morning we watched Haka chop celery and flirt with Noemi, the busty new Puerto Rican girl on the register, who wore tight, cap-sleeved shirts. "Great Dane," said Lucia, pointing to security screen 2. "Right,"
I said, watching Haka wave a paring knife with his graceful young limbs.
What a heartbreaker, said Lucia. Look at those eyes.
Watch out, new girl, I said.
Ay-ya,
said Lucia. We laughed. She asked me to take Yona to see the doctor. She had an interview with a prominent food critic in Astoria, for which she trotted out a vintage pair of Mary Jane pumps, red suede. Yoni hated doctors, she said. She'd found him a woman doctor who spoke Hebrew with an office only 6 blocks away. I was touched. I couldn't remember my sister being so thoughtful in the past. He made me peppermint green tea that morning.
Shakshuka,
he said. Oh no, I said. That's okay. He brought me vegan chocolate orange pound cake.
Lucy's favorite,
he said. I tasted it, and it was surprisingly moist. That might have been the first time I was alone with him. We walked quickly, without saying much, though when he spied an old boombox awaiting disposal, he whipped out his pocket knife, pried out the batteries, dropped one onto the sidewalk.
No bounce, you see. This one is good.
You could take the whole thing, I suggested.
Nah,
he said.
I got boombox. Better one than this.
At the doctor's office, the secretary handed him a clipboard full of forms. He handed them to me.
Please,
he said, quietly but without any shame. Name, I said. Birthday. Symptoms, I said. Family medical history. Check all that apply. That's when I found out Yona's father had died of lung cancer at the age of 44. Yona's age. Our mother had died of lung cancer, too. Though she smoked only 2 months, back when we first emigrated from Shanghai to Tennessee. Lucia never knew how it was. Stuck in third uncle's house. Banished to the basement. Ma gagging because it smelled like feet. My sister was a colicky baby. Howling, red-faced. To calm her, I'd aggressively belt out Chinese lullabies. Or the Popeye theme song. Or one of the old southern spirituals I learned at school. So strange to me as a child. Ezekiel connected them dry bones. Ezekiel connected them dry bones. Ezekiel in the valley of dry bones. Now hear the word of the Lord. I'd never heard the Lord say a thing. But a girl at school said if I prayed to him, I might get what I wanted. So I prayed for him to strike down Third Uncle so he would no longer assail us with profanities. Or insult Ma's cooking. Or throw dishes down the stairs when the baby cried. These were the years our mother's lips remained pressed into a tight, thin line. Every morning I was called up to Third Uncle's room to wash his feet and rub his bunions with tiger tooth liniment. Every afternoon I'd run home from school, study quickly, so I could care for Lucia when our mother left for her night classes. Ma, why did we have to come to America?
Ay-ya, Noor. Very complicated. Family matters. Your ba thought it was good idea.
But our father had died in a car accident 6 months ago, when we were still back in China. I did not understand family matters. Day after day, I sat alone in the cafeteria, picking at the grains of rice in my thermos, afraid to look up. Only 18 months later would I meet a girl in art club who shared with me her brand new crepas, then her Malamars. Even invited me to her house to show me her Vidal Sassoon hairdryer, and how to blow out my hair and set it with hairspray instead of always wearing it in a single braid down my back. Tess Carter, a true blue-eyed blonde, who would transform those years into something bearable. And on the last day of 5th grade, when Ma announced she'd accepted a job in New Jersey, Tess and I had wailed and sobbed, swore to write every day on the Hello Kitty stationery we picked out together at the Hallmark store. And though the letters dwindled, we would reunite, fortuitously, in New York City, for college at Barnard. My first American friend would last for life. Yona was in the examination room a long time. When he came out, his face was red and he paid the receptionist quickly from the thick wad of cash he always carried in his pocket. Is everything okay? I said.
Listen, he said. I'm gonna tell you something. Doctors, they don't do nothing. Never I had a lady tell me to cough and then squeeze my fucking balls.
I laughed. I thought, sometimes this Yona is a funny man.
He came on vacation with us that first summer. Lucia and I liked to rent a cottage on Cape Cod with a few of our friends. I invited Tess, who came from the city with her new boyfriend, the two of them all gushing and googly-eyed. Yona invited his uncle Leo, who lived upstairs and kept the books at the store.
"Avocado,"
whispered Lucia, and I recognized him instantly when I drove to fetch him from the bus station. Uncle Leo was short and stocky, wide at the bottom instead of up top, and wore round, rimless glasses and a yarmulke that covered most of his hair. He had unfortunately fat feet, I recall.
"So, you are the sister,"
he said. He eyed me head to toe.
"Where do you live, sister?"
"In Providence," I said.
"Providence!"
He laughed out loud. I found him rude. I did miss New York. But after Ma's third remission, I'd finally left the soulless Midtown consulting firm where I'd worked for 7 years. Moved to Providence to help implement a new strategic plan for an arts foundation.
"But what do you do?"
said Uncle Leo. And I explained I mostly managed their finances.
"Aha!"
he said.
"So you are good with money. Good at math."
He nodded at me with new respect. We went swimming. Yona and Uncle Leo complained it was too cold.
"Hof, door," said Yona. "Now that's a real beach."
He spoke loudly about their houses in Haifa and Jerusalem, how they were furnished with antiques. And Uncle Leo spoke about how business was booming and how they could soon buy a new property in Williamsburg and expand the store.
"This is America," said Yona.
"Listen, you know about air rights?"
"Air rights?" said Tess.
"Greedy yuppie developers," said Yona. "They want to build 12 floors of luxury apartments on the corner, where now is that car park. The neighborhood lets each building have 6 floors. They want more.
But I have only 4. Sure, they can buy 2 floors of my air."
He laughed, puffing rings of blue smoke.
$2 million,
said Uncle Leo, slapping us all high fives.
"My wife will never have to work again,"
said Yona, grabbing Lucia's tiny waist.
"You think you know my sister," I thought. "My sister loves her work. She has no interest in being a rich man's wife." I thought, this Yona is an arrogant man.
That evening he grilled pounds and pounds of kosher chicken breast and potatoes.
"Kosher chicken is the best chicken,"
he said.
"Lots of paprika,"
said Uncle Leo, and we all murmured that it was indeed very good and very well spiced. After dinner we retired to the screened-in porch, where I brought out a large bag full of canvases and tubes of acrylic paints. As a child, this had been my primary entertainment. Hours and hours lost in colors and textures on 12-by-16-inch matte boards layered thick with experiment. Sometimes Lucia and I played Crazy Eights or Chinese chess. Sometimes I taught Lucia math as our mother had taught me, by sitting her in my lap asking her to calculate how many chickens, how many pigs, in a barnyard with 18 feet and 6 heads. I pulled out a canvas of sunflowers I'd painted the summer before.
"Yeah,"
said Yona.
"It's beautiful."
"Beautiful," said Lucia. "She has always been an artist."
I blushed.
"You must hang your paintings in our gallery,"
he said. "What gallery?" I said.
"We make a gallery in the cafe at the store,"
he said. "So now you think you also know art," I thought. "Maybe you should paint something," I said. "Do you want to paint?"
"Yeah,"
he said. He was enthusiastic, I admit. Lucia loved that about him. I watched the two of them squeeze huge gobs of blue and yellow and red onto paper plates.
"A duck," said Lucia. "I'm going to paint you. A duck."
"A goose," said Yona. "Lucy Goosey, I'm going to paint you. A goose."
He mashed my squirrel hair brushes into the goopy plate and I winced. When he was finished, the goose was a yellow blob standing on thin orange sticks, anchored by triangularish green blocks I recognized as similar to Uncle Leo's feet. Lucia's duck was muddy brown, with one orange wing.
Duck and goose!
She glowed.
We are duck and goose,
said Yona, beaming, and they danced around the cottage and they kissed. He entertained our friends, smoking late into the night. I coughed in my bed. Through the buzzing of mosquitoes, I could hear Uncle Leo telling stories of childhood in Moscow, eating stale bread and goulash, cold beet soup. They spoke, too, of Israel, their days in the Israeli army. I imagined Yona dressed in camouflage, learning how to load a gun, disarm a grenade, living in a tin can hut, rows of concrete bunkers looming on the dusty horizon. I knew nothing about Moscow, or Israel, or the Israeli army.
Do you remember the tents?
Said Uncle Leo. In the desert dark, it was cold. They were allowed their own pillows, and as homesick boys they squeezed them tight, as if to wring out their fear. They joked about Passover, about the matzah, heavy in their bellies, that kept them awake and constipated all night. That night I learned Yona had trained as a marksman, that he'd lost his arm when he tried to remove a Palestinian boy's body from the path of an IDF tank. In the morning I sat on the front porch in my Adirondack chair, reading a book, while he and Lucia panted and groaned upstairs. I wished to be glad for their happiness. One day in the fall, he called. He never called. It was Lucia who called, usually once every week, to tell me about the poetry slam in the cafe where they'd served sulfite-free organic wine, or what they'd done for Rosh Hashanah, or the shakshuka she'd cooked for all the workers in the store.
3 cartons of eggs!
And Yona would yell from the background in his sing-song voice,
Jay, come visit us soon!
Or,
Me and Lucy Goosey, we miss you! Everything here is beautiful!
This time he whispered.
Listen, he said. Something is happening.
His rough voice wavered.
Lucia, she stopped sleeping and she is laughing and laughing in the shower all night. This morning, she is crying. She is telling me I am filming her on the security screens. Bad people are making movies of her in our room.
I was in the middle of preparing a chocolate souffle, having been invited by a bungee-jumping financial analyst to his apartment for a third date. I turned off the oven, boarded the next train to New York, withholding fat tears I hoped our mother could not see from her grave. She needs a doctor, I said.
I hate doctors,
said Yona. She needs a doctor, I said. This is how Lucia looked. Empty. Pale. Limp. Like old celery.
Why is this happening?
He said. It had happened once before. 3 years earlier. Not long after she'd finished graduate school. One doctor I'd spoken with explained that such episodes could be triggered by stress. Or drugs. Or trauma. Or exhaustion. Or sometimes, nothing at all.
Can't you do something?
I said. No, said the doctor.
What do you mean, no?
I said. No. Simply, no. Not unless her condition worsened significantly, such that she posed an imminent risk of harm to herself or others. Until then, no, we could not help her if she did not wish to be helped. All we could do was wait. She lost her first real job with a newspaper in Connecticut. Worked as a coat check girl at a trendy Manhattan bar. Lost that job, too. For a while she came to stay with me in Providence. Slept on a pull-out couch in the living room. One minute she babbled on about serpents and spies. The next she fell mute like a shadow. When we hung out with friends, her tangential interjections turned every gathering tense. One weekend, Tess came to visit and we went out to a club to see Lucia's old college friend's indie pop band.
How do you like living here?
Tess asked.
I live on Earth, hello, and it's getting polluted, said Lucia. Don't bother to breathe the air.
Oh, pollution is bad, said Tess.
But Providence must be better than New York.
They must be living in a recession, said Lucia.
Or regression.
I could see Tess blink.
It's just math. It's not like everyone there's a genius.
Have you heard the new Dave Matthews album?
I asked Tess, trying to deflect attention. And we exchanged opinions until our voices trailed off and Lucia murmured,
Matthew is a liar. He's always been a liar. He's just lying all the time until he wakes up.
Tess glanced at me, alarmed.
Is she okay? Everyone whispered.
No, I said. It was all I could say. She hardly ate, rarely bathed. But in the mornings, she marched out carrying her reporter's notebook, and in the evenings, she returned. One day, she said she wanted to move back to New York. I don't think that's a good idea, I said. But by evening, she was already gone. That episode lasted 9 months. It was a young jogger who alerted a policewoman, who brought her into the emergency room. She'd been sitting on top of a manhole cover in the middle of the street, cold and disoriented, singing at the top of her lungs. I took the next train into the city, rushed to the hospital, signed the papers for her involuntary commitment. Two psychiatrists signed in agreement. Now the hospital could hold her against her will. When I found her the next day in the psychiatric unit, wearing blue scrubs and paper slippers, she shot me a look of blank hatred.
You, she said. You put me here.
That day after I left the ward, I waited patiently until the elevator doors pinched closed. Then I broke down in tears. Our mother came from New Jersey, bewildered.
What has happened, Nyar?
She asked. But when I tried to explain, she shook her head, unable or unwilling to comprehend. In the tiny communal kitchen of the 38th Street Y, she cooked up a storm. Fish congee, lion's head meatballs, char siu and shrimp fried rice. Twice daily she brought meals into the hospital, where doctors and nurses carrying clipboards came and went. Ghost-like and evasive. Ma, brisk, removing Tupperware lids.
Ma po tofu and watercress, your favorites, Xiao Mei.
And if Lucia would eat, Ma would hover, scoop rice or fetch salt or a straw or a paper napkin to wipe the table. And if she did not, Ma would fret and dither.
You need to eat, Xiao Mei. Are you getting enough sleep? You leave this place, we go shopping. I buy you proper bed. Not that thing.
You mean a futon, Ma?
Ayah, futon no good. Too soft, no good. Bad for your back. Too close to the floor. No good. Give you arthritis.
And on she went, as if a flaccid mattress could be held accountable for Lucia's present condition. Every other day I commuted to my office in downtown Providence, returned at night to the 38th Street Y, where the skinny window in our room faced a slab of brick wall. One evening I found our mother standing with her face pressed to the glass. From the portable radio that accompanied her wherever she traveled, the classical music station playing Madama Butterfly, Luciano Pavarotti, her favorite. And when she saw me, something burst inside. She wept, shoulders stiff, with quick, choppy breaths. And it shocked me. I had not seen her like this since we lived with Third Uncle. The doctors will figure it out, Ma. It'll be okay. Ma, inconsolable. And I wondered if I should not have tried so hard to shield her from Lucia's erratic behavior the past several months. But she'd been exhausted from her treatments. I had not wanted to burden her further.
Your sister. Always such a happy child. Wild, yes, but so happy.
And then her gasps slowed, and her face went cloudy with that faraway gaze I still could not decode. For 1 month we'd stayed in that dreary place. But slowly, my sister returned. Like a miracle. Our Lucia. It was not my story to tell. But now it was clear. As I'd feared,
Lucia had never told her new husband these things. Maybe she was afraid he wouldn't understand. Or maybe she'd wanted to believe, as I did, that nightmares could stay forever in the dark. Yona tried to calm her. She scowled. She pushed him away. And it hurt him, I could see. I tried to trick her. I said, Lucia, you need to sleep. I can't sleep. Not with them watching me. I said, you'll feel better in a place where you can sleep. Finally, Yona said,
listen to your sister, Lucy. No cameras there. No nothing. Just quiet room for you to sleep.
She said, maybe I need sleep. In the emergency room, she squirmed and Yona cradled her head to his chest. When the nurse asked him questions, I answered and filled out her forms. Yona's mother's friend's grandson, Amit, was flopped on the twin mattress that night. His essence was a lump of boiled ham. Yona let me sleep in the bed, and he slept on the long, cushioned bench in the cafe, though he hardly slept. And in the morning I lay awake by myself and watched security screens 2 and 3, where long-limbed Haka was kissing Noemi, whose tight pink cap-sleeved shirt now clung to her melon-shaped belly. Lucia slept for 18 hours. And when we visited the next day, she was livelier, less irritable, more herself, though her eyes still seemed cloudy, vague. Yona brought her beet salad and ginseng snacks and her favorite pound cake.
Can she come home now?
He asked. He could not stand to leave her. No, I said. I don't think so. Not yet. She was stubborn. I did not remember her being so stubborn the last time. She said,
doctors don't know anything about how I feel.
She said,
I want to go home.
She cried. Yona kissed her. He said,
don't worry. We're gonna go home soon.
That day he tried to feed her the small white pill himself, the one the pale, veiny nurse brought in a plastic cup.
You take this, Lucy Goosey. We go home. I make you shakshuka.
When that didn't work, he scolded her like a child.
Listen, Lucy, I am serious. No more playing games now.
And when that didn't work either, the pale, veiny nurse sighed. And when the same thing happened the next day, Yona said,
this is stupid. She sit here in this jail. And the doctors, they don't do nothing.
He told the pale nurse and the doctor, a stallion, most definitely a stallion.
I am her husband. I am taking care of her. I am taking her home.
Please, Yona, I said. You can't do that. She's not well.
She's not an animal,
he said. She's sick, I said.
They lock her up like animal.
Please, be patient. It takes time.
3 days she's here. They don't do nothing. This is stupid.
It took a month last time. 1 month. But she took the medicine and got better. Really better. I spoke deliberately, as if to a simpleton, but he only shook his head.
They don't understand her,
he said. No, you don't understand. She has an illness. Lucia sat alone by the window, scanning the view with hollow eyes. Look at her, I pleaded. She's sick. That's not her.
Gia, listen.
He lowered his voice.
I know, Lucia. This place, these doctors, it's no good for her.
You know, Lucia.
You.
I choked back my words, furious. I pulled out a folder full of pamphlets and notes and clinical papers, which I'd saved for 3 years. FAQs for caregivers. Bipolar symptoms and signs. 25 tips for coping with schizophrenia. She has a mental illness, I said. I brandished the folder like a weapon of proof. This hospital is to help her.
She needs help. Can't you see?
This hospital is bullshit!
He roared. I flung the pamphlets and notes and clinical papers he could not read in his face. You are an ignorant, ignorant man.
This is jail,
he said. And in the end, he won. He was her husband. They had to listen to him. I returned to Providence. I saw the bungee-jumping financial analyst. I apologized, explained. He stared at his dinner plate, chewed his lamb kebab laboriously, his discomfort seeping through the silences. I did not see him again. I tried to contact Lucia's former psychotherapist, an astute young woman with whom I'd spoken several times after Lucia's first break. Lucia has remarkable insight. This is encouraging, she'd said.
Encouraging?
For prognosis, because these kinds of illnesses are most often lifelong conditions, she said. I didn't believe her. Denial was easy, back then.
Dr. Hassan no longer works here, said the receptionist. May I get her new number? Dr. Hassan moved to London over a year ago.
Click. The line went dead. That night I dreamed I was back at Third Uncle's house. His room, odorous, like dirty socks. Third Uncle, stretched out watching Bonanza on the television, spitting watermelon seeds into a potato chip bag. His short, stubby toes. Those thick yellow toenails. The sound of his click-clicking teeth.
Ah, Nyar! Come help your uncle!
I watched in horror as the bunion on his left foot grew to the size of a small eggplant. I retched. High-pitched wails rang in my ears, like sirens.
Shut up!
Yelled Third Uncle.
Shut up with all your crying, Wang Batan!
I tumbled downstairs to the basement. Found Ma crouched in the closet, eyes puffy and red. A door slammed. The baby shrieked. Give her to me, Ma. I'll take care of her. Lucia said she did not like her work in Queens anymore. The subway was too loud. She said she would write from home, and Yona let her work from their bed, which she covered with stacks of her color-coded papers. To me, he said,
here always are people, in and out, and every day she stay in our room. She need rest. She need quiet. This city, it make people depressed.
I tried to talk to her, but this is what I sensed. Something murky. A detachment. Long pauses and gaps in her thoughts. She was still Lucia, perhaps, but muffled, disjointed, fractured into a thousand pieces. She refused to answer if I asked about her medications. I blamed him. I admit I did. But he brought her beet salad, cooked her shakshuka, bought her trinkets from the flea market, coaxed and joked and made her laugh. He indulged her, like a child. So what was I to do? By this time, I too was in transition, with a rigid new boss at the Arts Foundation. Your mother, your sister. Yes, I know it's been difficult, Miranda, but perhaps it's time you considered a more family-friendly organization. My insides deflated. My face burned. Though he was not altogether unkind. With his recommendation, I was able to find a fundraising position up in Boston, where I soon met a tall Swiss urologist, introduced to me by a colleague as a potential tennis partner. Our first match, the tall Swiss urologist played hard. He did not attempt to make small talk or flirt or humor me between points, but focused down on the ground, or up at the ball, or on the strings of his racket, as if to look elsewhere would breach a seriousness he was required to sustain. Though in the end, he lost, 6-4, and he approached the net dutifully with an outstretched hand.
You're tough,
he said, shaking his head. High school varsity,
I mumbled. And for a moment I worried that I'd bruised his fragile male ego, that I'd miscalled a few shots, that he would refuse another contest. I'd enjoyed it. We were so evenly matched. But then he reached an arm around my shoulders, the slightest embrace, and I caught him smiling a quick private smile to himself, which I dared to interpret as a shy admiration. His name was Stefan. Recently divorced, he'd come to Boston to consult for a global health organization. We went to an Irish pub, where he joked and flirted and looked me in the eye, laughed when I told him about the woman doctor who squeezed unsuspecting balls. A few weeks later, our first road trip to Maine, car trouble and rain left us stranded the entire weekend in a musty motel outside Augusta. Nevertheless, we'd ordered lobsters and French fries and dined in bed. Watched the Wildlife Channel. Learned about mating behaviors of the Congolese bonobos. Had frighteningly good sex. Our last night there, I was stricken with food poisoning. As mortifying as it was wretched. He brought me fresh towels, ice, changed the sheets, and by the time I woke the next morning, he'd returned already from the convenience store, armed with bananas, saltines, and ginger ale, along with two soft bristled toothbrushes, the kind I liked. On the long drive home, our conversation turned serious. I learned his wife had left him for a professional skier, moved to Austria with their son.
Your son?
Raphael, 12, now in boarding school.
I'm sorry,
said Stefan.
I really...
He drew a breath to recalibrate.
This was completely juvenile. I should have told you earlier, and I don't know why I didn't. I think I worried you would run away.
Flushed, flustered, and I had not seen him like this, less than composed. Do you miss him? I asked.
I do,
he said.
It's difficult being so far away, and my ex doesn't make things any easier.
He reached for my hand, stopped midair.
Are you angry, Miranda? If you're angry, I understand.
But I could not say I felt angry or alarmed, deceived or betrayed. If anything, this news seemed to frame him in a softer light. And I found his contrition oddly sweet, his fallibility reassuring.
What's his essence? Asked Lucia.
I pictured Stefan's steady brown eyes, his noble demeanor.
Elk?
I said.
Elk!
She said.
Is that like partway between a deer and a moose?
And she giggled and sounded mostly like herself. Until the next time. When she would sound hard and vacant like a parking lot.
Are you writing?
I asked.
What?
She said. How is she? I'd ask Yona.
She's perfect,
he'd say, but not in his sing-song voice.
Maybe we're gonna move to a house upstate, when I find some more money. Maybe I sell the store.
He sounded tired. I didn't ask what had happened to air rights. That summer, Uncle Leo disappeared.
What do you mean, disappeared?
I said.
Poof,
said Lucia.
Vanished, like magic.
Vanished, like magic? Later I learned he'd absconded with $66,000, had been embezzling from the store for more than 2 years. Yona flew immediately to Israel. I don't know if he found him. Lucia said everyone argued over whether to report Uncle Leo to the police. Yona said no. Uncle Leo was family. When he returned, his son Johnny was with him. Johnny was a handsome boy of 18. Not tall, not short, but robust and athletic, with fiery eyes and dyed black hair. He did not want to go into the Israeli army. He displaced Amit, the boiled ham, and lived on the twin mattress and helped prepare salads in the store. Pasta with sun-dried tomatoes. Black bean couscous, kelp with beets. He played video games and smoked and loitered with the neighborhood characters. And one night, after he had to be fetched from the police station for being drunk and high and harassing a lesbian at the tattoo parlor,
Yona slapped him across the face. And they fought. And when Lucia walked in,